So you saw Interstellar?
I did. On Saturday, it was a nothing day. I had done nothing. And I was like, this was a waste. And then a friend called and was like, you want to go to this movies? And I said, yes, sir.
So I'm jonesing to hear the full David recap.
Well, you didn't see it yet, right?
I have not seen it, so I would prefer no spoilers, but I definitely want to know how you felt about what Nolan did, and was it too long, was it too big, all the questions that I've been hearing about.
I can't do the full DM recap without talking all about it, but I don't think it was too long. All of us agreed it did not feel like 2 hours and 49 minutes. It basically lined up with most of the reviews I read. It was pretty good. It wasn't the best thing I've ever seen. You should totally go see it. You should definitely see it in the theater. You should see it in IMAX if you can.
Did you see it in IMAX 3D explosions?
Not 3D, but yes, IMAX. I saw it in the... I looked up... The Interstellar website has a list of like all the different formats it's being shown in, so we found the closest one to us that had 70mm film IMAX rather than digital IMAX. It was totally worth it. Just like the visuals, the 80-foot screen and the sound, you can like feel the rocket engines firing. Like, it's really cool. And like a lot of Nolan stuff, there's these big set pieces that look really amazing, and are shot really well. I don't know. I feel like I have to tread so lightly because you haven't seen it, but, go see it, I guess is the short version.
All right. Fair enough. I was definitely concerned about the runtime but most people I've seen, most people I know who have seen it have said what you said, which is it doesn't feel that long. I'm curious to know, there's someone I know who saw it said about 2 hours in, roughly, I was like, oh man, I'm really going to be bummed out if it's going where I think it goes. But then by the end of the movie, he was like, oh, I was very satisfied.
Well, what you said to me before was that not so much if it's going where he thought it was going, but if it ended where he thought it might end. That's what you said to me before. And if it's the point that I'm thinking of, I actually might have preferred the movie if it ended at that point.
No, at this point, is this like still with like an hour to go?
I wouldn't say it was that long, maybe a half an hour.
Okay.
There's a couple of different points that I feel like he might be talking about, and I'd be curious to know which one he meant specifically.
All right, I'll have to get the full Monty recap once I go see it. but as a father of a daughter, I have no chance.
No chance. No chance. It's as a great poet once said, "You done, son."
All right, I will bring a blanket made of Kleenex to make sure that'll hold me together. All right, I'm looking forward to it. It definitely might be on the agenda for this weekend.
Cool.
In unrelated news, the NBA in their quest to conquer every uniform ever created always have released this year's Christmas Day uniforms. So I wanted to chat about that. And first, I just want to do a recap of last year's uniforms, which I thought were a travesty. And I think that might have kicked off our original sleeve talk, like way back when.
Yeah.
But last year, they were sleeve jerseys, essentially one color, and I likened them to pajamas.
They were pajama-esque. You spend all of Christmas Day in your pajamas anyway, so it made sense.
There you go. This year, I'm not sure how to describe them, but essentially the style is small team logo on the chest, number below. So rather than having the word Cavaliers, it's the C with the sword, for instance, and then, you know, LeBron's number. And then on the back, it's a big number, and the first name under the number in like a fabric rectangle, almost like you might see in like old hockey jerseys. But it's the first name and it's below the number. Did I miss anything?
I don't think so.
And as is typical of the NBA in recent years, there's five games where there's 10 teams that are participating. I'm going to miss some of them, but it's Cavs, Wizards, Lakers,
Bulls,
Knicks,
Houston, I believe.
I can't think of all of them.
Yeah.
But anyhow, they're an interesting look. I guess that's how I would qualify or quantify it. I didn't know if you had any gut reaction to them.
Well, going with the theme of last year's gut reaction was pajamas, my gut reaction for this year is practice jersey. That's what it screams to me.
Yeah, that's a good way to look at it.
Like the little mesh thing that you threw on over top of your t-shirt when you went to practice after high school.
Very much so. And on the Warriors one in particular, the ratio of size between the logo and the numbers seems way off. Like the number is just ginormous and that circular Warriors logo, basketball logo, seems teeny tiny.
Yeah, I see what you're saying.
And it felt like the relationship of those two elements was off on that one in particular. Not necessarily true on all the unis, but I felt like it was a little bit out of balance. I don't dislike the back of the jerseys. I think they work all right. The Wizards one might be my favorite.
I was going to say the Cavs is my favorite.
And the Cavs are probably my second favorite, so we're in the same ballpark.
Somehow the wine and gold really works with the like rectangle nameplate on the Cavs jersey.
I like the gold number, or rather the gold letters there, like you said, just because it almost doesn't feel like it's tacked on like some of the other jerseys do. That one feels, yes, like it makes sense.
Yeah. And what I like about all of them all told is that they use team typography pretty consistently. The Warriors jersey is if it's not copper plate like it is in their logo, it's damn close. I think part of the reason I like the Cavs one the best is because it has that sort of condensed typeface, which I always think looks better on a uniform.
The Wizards uses that too, and it reads so much better than serif type, for instance.
Yes. The Warriors one is a weird mismatch. It's the sort of fancy serif for the numbering, and then a sort of slab serif for the lettering, and the juxtaposition doesn't really work for me.
Golden State numbers are in copper plate, right?
That's what I'm guessing. The their regular logo definitely is in copper plate,
which seems bizarre. Copperplate to me was like always like a throw-in system font.
Yeah, I
now
feel
we're getting
this
into like deep font nerders.
No, we need to. I feel the same way about it. There's a lot of people who think that the Warriors' regular uniforms are the best in the league, and copperplate just stares me in the face every time I see them.
Yeah, you're preaching to the choir on that one. Back to the, you mentioned using the team typography for the first names, which I thought was really smart. And you talked about the legibility of the Wizards and the Cavs using, you know, a compressed sans serif typeface, which works really well. Then you go over to the Bulls, where they use like a serif type for their last names, or in this case, first names. But it reads much more poorly on the Bulls jerseys because it's like red with a black outline. You lose all those serifs, and it's not as strong or it doesn't look as tight as one element as, say, the Wizards and the Cavs jerseys.
Yeah, it's way too much with the outline and the thick strokes of the letters. It's especially on the what we're looking at is they've released sort of like the star player jerseys, and the Bulls one is obviously Derrick Rose, and you almost lose the negative space in the K because it's like bleeding out into the areas in between the terminals.
Agreed. Quick side question, which is, do you prefer your NBA jerseys with a crew neck or a V-neck?
Crew neck completely.
So crew neck always, no matter what.
Yes. And then I would also put V-neck secondary before the weird wishbone neck that a lot of teams have had, including this Warriors jersey has what I'm talking about, and the Pacers do it, and the Heat do it, I believe.
Yeah, that's the shape is just unnatural.
Yeah, I don't get it. It's never looked good to me. Classic crew neck has always been my way to go.
I'm with you. So I think V-neck works in some cases, but majority of the time, crew neck wins out.
It's really the Bulls jersey that I think suffers the most from the practice jersey moniker, because their regular uniforms are so simple and so minimal that it looks more drastic in this case. Like, you talk about the Wizards one, you liken that one more. In a sense, the Wizards one almost looks more like the regular jersey because it has the shoulder blocking and the stripe across the chest. And the Bulls one just looks like someone ironed on some logos onto a blank jersey that they bought at TJ Maxx or something.
Yeah, it's the Bulls logo in particular looks so out of place. Like it's 200% too small.
Yeah. And it's the Cavs one is very simple too, but somehow it looks so much stronger. Maybe it's the fact, maybe the Bulls one, like we're only seeing the road Bulls and the road Wizards, but we get to see the home Warriors and the home Cavs. I wonder if they would be different if it was a white Bulls jersey, whether we'd have a different opinion.
Back when you were living in Ohio and it was LeBron round one, they had the uniforms before this most recent incarnation. They had the kind of almost slanted Cavaliers type with the big giant C on them.
Yeah.
Did you feel like those were better or worse than the current uniforms? Or neither?
I want to say neither. This current iteration is growing on me. Because it is very simple. I'm so used to the orange and blue Cavs from when we grew up that I didn't even know until they switched to this wine and gold that they call that was their original jersey color, like back in the 70s, like when Austin Carr was playing there. And I sort of like that now that they've gotten back to their roots, you know, and it's one of the simpler uniform sets now, so I appreciate that. I think at times that old with the script Cavaliers on it was sort of suffered from looking too much like every other uniform that popped up in the late 90s and early 2000s.
For me, the current Cavs ones are a little too bland. We've talked about that before. And the ones before that for LeBron round one just seem weird. A little too much going on with the crazy C. And
They weren't bland, but they were generic to me.
That's a good way of putting it.
And I think the current ones are definitely not generic, which, so I think it's an, I guess I'd say a slight improvement.
And then there were the god-awful ones when my boy Sean Kemp was there.
Oh, yeah.
That just, that were black with just like a blue, I don't even know what to call it, a paint splatter? And they were just bad news bears.
Yeah, weird orange and blue triangles on them. They looked like the, remember those Skybox trading cards from back in the day?
Yes. Would it be like an action shot, but it was green screened out and they would put weird shapes behind them?
Yeah.
Oh, Skybox trading cards. That one just brought me back.
I love those cards.
I must say, when I was a heavy collector, it was definitely mostly basketball. But the specific set that got me the most excited was, I want to say it was 92-93, just in that year, Fleer Ultra. They had like sheared type in the bottom right-hand corner, like a triangle coming in. So like almost like the bottom right-hand corner was cut off by the name and the team color and stuff like that. And I loved those cards. And I invested some serious cashola in those.
Oh, you're damn right. When I went to, my mom recently moved out of my childhood home. And when I went back there, there was, you know, 8 or 10 shoeboxes full of baseball, basketball, and football cards. And I went through and I sort of whittled them down to a select few of, like, not cards that are worth anything because none of them are, but just like, these are meaningful because this was a big part of my life once. And these, I sort of kept it to these are guys that I'm going to think it's cool 60 years from now that I saw them play.
Yeah, that's a good way of putting it. And you're right. Generally speaking, most of the cards that you and I have now aren't worth the paper they're printed on.
Oh, nothing. And we were promised so much when we were kids. Like the Beckett magazine, I was checking it like every month. Like, oh, my, you know, Frank Thomas rookie card's up to $2.50. I can only imagine what this will be like in 2050. And it's like, it's just a piece of paper. That's all it is. It's like Beanie Babies.
Oh, man. Now that our daughter goes over to my parents at least once a week, she plays with little Beanie Babies. And I honestly, the amount of money my parents spent on those, I ought to sock them in the nose. I mean, there's triple digits Beanie Babies in my parents' house. It's craziness. My. Yeah, it's bad news.
I guess it's finally paying off in Toys for Harper. You can save some cash there.
There you go. It's just backup toys. It's all the toys are remix toys. There's one particular Kevin Garnett card that I have that I really like. I remember trading. I got it from my brother and thought it was the greatest thing ever. And I have that. I mean, I have a bunch of cards saved somewhere, but that one card I can picture very vividly in my head. I was like, oh, I hope one day this is worth what it used to, you know, it used to be worth like $100 and now it's probably worth $1.50. But there are certain cards that, to your point, definitely have sentimental value, which is not a very Justin thing to do. I'm very like, get rid of material stuff, but there's a lot of cards that definitely have meaning to me.
Yeah, I try so hard. I can convince anybody else besides me to get rid of any junk, but when it's my junk, I can't do it. but anyway, I one of the boxes that I had cards in was actually a tin box from Skybox from that 91 or whatever, when it had the white backgrounds with the crazy shapes. And I fit all of the remaining cards in that one tin, and I thought the tin was a pretty cool collector's item, and I held on to that too.
Nice. Yeah, I have a handmade wooden box that my uncle made me a really long time ago that has like my initials on it, and it, you know, it fits a couple hundred cards in it, and that's good stuff. We'll have to do a really nerdy basketball card or a card episode. I'll have to dig out all my old goodies.
Oh yeah.
And no one will listen, and it will be great.
Right.
I must say, this blows my mind. There was one card store that was in a town called Abington, a few towns away from me. And that's where my brother and I, or rather, that's where my mom used to drive my brother and I. That was the one card store we went to, you know, a dominant majority of the time. And whatever, this is back in like, you know, early to mid-90s when the card industry was a boom and we loved going there, blah, blah, blah. Fast forward to 2014... The store still exists. Now it's moved up the street a little and like a little bit of a smaller footprint, but I have no idea how they're staying in business.
It's still a card store? It's not a front for anything?
For all I know, it could be a front. They
just kidding, card store, Abington, wherever you are. Just playing.
That's right. They I remember towards the end of the time I used to go there, they were doing a lot more memorabilia, and they were branching out, and they would do like, you know, they would do like Magic the Gathering tournaments there and stuff like that. So they must augment all those things, all the sales with other things like memorabilia or tournaments or whatnot. But I should go in there soon. It's not too far from where I'm at, and the guy won't remember me from a ham sandwich, but I mean, I'll buy one pack of cards. I'll get 8 cards for like $6, right?
Yeah.
Oh.
These kids today. Oh, they don't know. They don't know, man. I'm pretty sure the card store in my town ended up merging with the comic book store, and they just became one store. And I think that's long gone too.
That's if you wanted to get double nerderies on at the same time.
Oh yeah, which we did, of course.
Efficient nerderies. I remember. I had a giant bookshelf in my room, and the bottom shelf, you know, closest to the floor, was dedicated to like most of my cards. They weren't all there, but like everything that was latest and greatest was in there. And I was such a nerd that I had like a little wooden stand right in the center, and I would put a card, you know, in a hard plastic in there, and it would be my card of the week. Now, keep in mind, there's no audience for this. I'm just a total dope in my bedroom being like taking like a really hard look at, you know, recent card trends and being like, what card should be the card of the week? And I would actually put it there and swap it out once a week. Oh, good golly.
You've reached, that's a new level of nerd right there.
It is. I did not talk to girls until I was 28.
I think the worst I got was just the endless organizing. Like, I would spend a whole Saturday putting all of my baseball cards in alphabetical order by year, and then wait 2 weeks and then organize them all by by team, by player, by team, you know, regardless of year, just always rotating how they were stored.
What were your, you mentioned how much you liked the Skybox cards. Did you have any others that you were like, oh, I really like these? Like, looking back now on ones that I really liked, I'm like, oh, maybe I had good design taste back then.
I mostly remember, I didn't get into collecting basketball cards until a little later. I mostly remember baseball cards that I really dug. There were some Topps ones from the late 80s that had sort of the cursive, team name in cursive in the bottom right corner,
yep,
that I thought were really nice. I loved those. And I loved the Upper Deck baseball cards because they were the first ones that was sort of like looked modern. They had like full bleed photographs instead of a border, and they had little holograms on them. So I was always big into those.
I was also a fan of those full bleed photographs too. I can remember both in baseball and basketball, Top Stadium Club. The design was very, very minimal. It was like a little black square with the name and the Top Stadium Club logo, which might have been in like gold foil or something like that.
Yeah, definitely.
And those were always really sharp. And just whoever was the photo editor for a lot of those took pride in picking out really unique photographs. And they might not have even been action shots. You know, some of them were just somebody standing on a court, but the way it was lit was really interesting.
Mm.
So I remember those being ones that I really liked. And then later on, one of my buddies, close buddies growing up, was a hockey player and still a big hockey fan. He's, you know, just a hockey head. So we collected a lot of hockey cards. So when we would go to the store together, I usually get hockey cards. And there was a set like in like maybe the mid to late 90s that were called, like Black Diamond. I don't know if they were Upper Deck Black Diamond or Topps Black Diamond. And forgive anybody who's listening who's like, hey, Hastings, you idiot. You can't remember who it was. But those were really cool because you would get like single diamond, double diamond, triple diamond cards. And of course, the higher the diamonds, the more rare they are. And it was just really exciting to try and get a good player that was like a triple black diamond or whatever. I remember those being really fun to open the packs of.
Never had any hockey cards.
Yeah, I definitely have some buried in my boxes of fun. And then if you can picture what I would consider the classic Upper Deck baseball set from like, I'd say the early 90s with a white border, that trademark diamond logo. And then it had almost like the name was over almost like green grass on the bottom. Do you remember these? It was like a green grass background.
Yeah,
and the type
yes.
was in white.
Yes.
Okay. And that to me was like the when Upper Deck first came on the scene, I was like, whoa, what are these? And I remember I didn't have a ton of them, but I remember those being a big deal too.
Yeah, because it was coming on the heels of the ones I remember from just before that era were like the Donruss that had
yes.
the blue background.
Oh, blue, yeah.
With
yep,
the
yep,
weird
yep.
the weird like marks on them. And then there was a Fleer set that had red background and
yep.
like black squiggles. And then compared to those, the Upper Deck ones, they like I said before, they just looked so modern. It was like it was a big change.
This is what I did instead of going through puberty in the 90s. I chose not to mature. I chose instead to get really nerdy about cards. Now I'm jonesing to go through my old stuff. I'll have to do that soon.
Yeah, fire up some Twitter pics.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. That'll go over like a lead balloon, I'm sure.
And in Hoops, I loved the that Skybox one we've already talked about. And then the previous year's Skybox one was also cool. It was sort of the green screened out was a black background instead of white. And it had sort of a gold border around them. And the same sort of weird 3D computer graphics in the background. Both of those I thought were really cool.
Oh, that's right. I lost you for a bit, but now I can picture the black ones. The white ones in particular just looked like they were from the future.
Yeah.
Because, I mean, correct me if I'm wrong, say it was Michael Jordan, like, they silhouetted out every player and then put them on that kind of funky background, right?
Yeah, every now and then they might have had a defensive player in there, too. But that's what I liked about it, was because it wasn't just your regular picture from a basketball game. Like, it made it more interesting to die cut them out. Not really die cut, but, you know.
I want to do that as a fun side project, is try to design the ultimate trading card.
Mm.
Quick, I mentioned it in passing about the card store we used to go to, but getting deeper and deeper into the world of nerds. And this is not sports related at all. Did you ever play Magic, the card game?
Yeah. Oh yeah.
I think I have cards buried away somewhere, and I wouldn't show my face in public and play. But I would play, like, with my buddies or whatever, and I was never that good, and I was never into it enough that I could ever, you know, consistently play well against my friends, but that thing's still around.
Oh, for sure. Definitely. I never got into it that hard. I was just enough to, I had a couple of decks, and I played with my brother. I don't know if I ever played with the only other person I played with besides my brother, I think, was my high school girlfriend. You heard it, folks. Pulled a girlfriend, even with all this mess that we're talking about. Her kid brother was really into it, and he was into it in a way that I didn't even know existed. Like, he had multiple decks. He was like, yeah, this is my my water and fire deck, and then over here is my forest and death deck. And I was like, oh, I didn't even know that was a thing. I thought you just bought a handful of cards from the store and played from there. That was the full extent of my Magic life.
It got intense. Did you see that video that was going around the YouTuberies, like, maybe 4 to 6 weeks ago, where it's like a first-person view of a guy who opens up old packs of Magic cards? Have you seen this?
It's vaguely familiar, but I can't really think of it specifically.
And there's, like, an incredibly rare card that he finds at the end of the video. You know, it's worth like a quadrillion dollars, and he just loses his mind, and it's great. It's just like a total nerdgasm. It's fantastic. We'll make sure to link to it in the episode details. Back to hoops.
Wait, sports?
Yes. We have to reel in all the nerds and get back to things that are manly, like typefaces. With the start of the NBA season, of course, comes the start of the college basketball season. And our friend Paul Lucas at UniWatch did his big college basketball preview recently, which we tweeted about, and showing off all the different court designs and uniform designs that were happening this year. And I wanted to... in addition to that, we tweeted out the top 10 court designs in college hoops, which I thought was a great read. And I didn't know if you had any gut reaction to either new uniforms or kind of the top 10 court design. And were you upset that Syracuse wasn't in it?
I'd like to talk about the court designs a little bit. The big takeaway for me is that it definitely has picked up in the last couple of years, but I feel like this year is the year where court design is becoming a thing. It's like everybody and their sister's grandma has a new court this year, and it's becoming like the next step. Like, it used to be New Jersey's every year. Now it's like people are updating their courts like crazy, and I think it's interesting just to talk about the development of that and how some of these schools and NBA teams, too, are pushing it in weird directions.
It's definitely become very popular in recent years, and you're right, it's becoming a thing. And the part that I find most interesting is the way that the ESPNs of the world are covering it. It's like, hey, here's these new court designs, but often they'll show them off in a way that you would never really see. Like, when you get, like, the bird's eye view, no one ever sees the court like that. You know, 99% of people are only seeing the court through a TV broadcast. So, in my opinion, court design, for the most part, is for the TV broadcast. Because as long as there's enough contrast and, you know, the average basketball player can find the out-of-bounds line at the three-point line, you know, they're not really focused on how something's designed when they're middle of the game. So it's almost as if they're designed for the broadcast. And I always have found that interesting because there are so many schools these days, and even pro teams, who are trying to do, you know, the next most interesting thing on the court. Like with the Raptors, there was that faux 3D text they put on the baselines.
Yeah, the European thing.
Yeah, and it was at the University of Oregon last year that had, like, the crazy tree print and, like, the forest silhouette on the court.
Yep.
I think everybody's trying to look for that next big thing. And I don't know what the next big thing is, but there's definitely a lot of character that can come out for a team through its court design.
Well, before TV, the first thing they're designing for is, well, should be the players and the referees, because...
Correct.
You need to know where you are on the court, and the ref needs to know if you're out of bounds or whether it's a two-pointer or a three-pointer. And then... Once you go beyond those parameters, then you start getting into sort of art territory instead of design territory, I guess. The big thing this year seems to be city skylines. There's like five or six college teams that are throwing in the skyline of their city. Xavier's got one with Cincinnati. IUPUI has one with Indianapolis. I can't remember the others off the top of my head. But you and I prefer a minimalist look, a simple look. I lived 5 years in Columbus, Ohio. I don't think I'd be able to recognize a silhouette of the Columbus skyline if it walked in and punched me in the face. I don't know how effective those things are going to be, especially for cities that aren't like Seattle or Chicago with like or New York with like a definitive building in it, you know?
Yeah, the skyline thing isn't my favorite. Especially because when you're in the arena, you can really only put it on one side. And from the other side of the arena, it just looks weird.
Yeah, so, definitely.
So that's why I found last year when the Suns did their little mini rebrand or brand evolution, they came up with that word mark that is identical when you look at it both ways, which I thought was really smart.
Yeah, super cool.
So having some sort of symmetrical court design, I think it is always helps the experience. That's why I don't know the skylines always work. But obviously when it's not symmetrical, it's always set up for the TV broadcast. You know, it's going to be red on the side of the arena where the cameras are for all the folks at home.
Yeah. The Northwestern did a new one this year and theirs is symmetrical, their N logo. That brings us back around to Cuse. Cuse used to have the word Syracuse written in big letters above their S, but they got rid of that, which was a great move. And now their S is symmetrical, too. And in my completely biased opinion, yes, I do believe Syracuse should be on the top 10 court designs list that even Brennan did.
Especially since they got rid of that word mark above, which was unnecessary.
Yes, yeah, it never needed to be there. I'm glad they axed it after 1 year. The courts, they seem to be getting busier and busier. There's his top two were Indiana and North Carolina's courts, and I have your list lacks any credibility unless it starts with those two, in my opinion. they're just the classic, simple. I love the fact that they have the shape of the state at center court. Not many schools even have the opportunity to do that. You feel kind of bad for like maybe Indiana State or North Carolina State. They can't claim their own geographic borders, but it looks great. And they're not, especially when you look at the UniWatch article and see all the court designs, these two stand out in the way that they aren't flooded with the name of the arena on the somewhere outside the midcourt line or the ad for PNC Bank or whatever. That's just the court with the lines. It's a classic look. I hope it stays, you know, forever.
Even the layout of the arena itself, getting into like architecture, Indiana is really unique. It has like those a few rows of seats just behind the court, and then there's like that wall, almost like they have that at Pittsburgh too, I think.
Yeah, it's similar.
Yeah, so just that layout is very iconic for Indiana hoops, and it helps work with the layout of the court and the design of the court. The court that's always the most interesting to me is Vanderbilt.
Love the Vandy court.
On TV, it seems like Like, if you look, say, along the sideline where the benches would be, and then all the wood that exists between the sideline and where it ends, looks like you could land a jet on it because it's so different. And it's such a big amount of real estate where the benches aren't. I'd be curious to know what it's like to play there. And are you kind of off spatially? Yeah, are you kind of off spatially? Can you hear your coach from under the hoop, especially if he's shouting down all the other way at the end of the court? I'd just be really interested to see what players think. And maybe it doesn't matter once the whistles are blown and the ball gets thrown up, but it seems like something you'd have to get used to.
Yeah. On the positive side, though, you'd think that it would be safer for players because there's no – you have much less of that chance of injury when you're flying off the court and landing into chairs because they're backed up from the court a little bit, which I appreciate as a former player.
I agree. That's a good point. Player safety, Vanderbilt in the lead.
Yeah, leading the way. The newest sort of, aside from the cityscapes and the trees you mentioned on the Oregon court, in college and NBA, and probably in high schools now at this point, the biggest recent developments in court design seem to be the different wood stains for different areas of the court. What's your take on those?
That's my general take. I feel like in the NBA, I feel like the Timberwolves were one of the first ones to do it.
Mm-hmm.
And they had quite a different contrast between kind of the darker wood that filled up most of the court and the lighter inside. I don't know that it's necessary. I mean, if you have enough contrast between the wood grain color and the three-point line, for instance, you shouldn't need it. I don't know. I don't feel too strongly about it either way.
I don't generally know what the purpose is. There's already a line to tell you where the three-point line is. I mean, I guess maybe you could argue it helps a player sort of subliminally and quickly know where they are on the court, but I think most of those guys know that stuff anyway. To me, it's unnecessary. I guess it can look nice in certain scenarios. The thing is, to me, that most of the schools and teams that have that then go a step further and keep the lane, keep the wood grain there. And I've always been one who's preferred my paint painted, or else Hubie Brown would never, it would be meaningless when he talked about how the key to control the painted area.
The 3-second area.
If it's not painted.
I'm with you. Painted is, I believe, necessary to differentiate both for the broadcast audience and for the players. It makes a lot of sense.
Or the old Atlanta Hawks had the advertising synergy with the Dutch boy points in the paint. If the paint's not paint, what's a Dutch boy going to do? He's out of a job.
There's no equivalent to the so-and-so's 3 seconds in the 3-second area. I laughed when I saw the SMU court on the top 10 list because of the obnoxious size of the logo. And I could hear you cringing from a couple states over. It's so huge. It basically goes from three-point line to three-point line. And it seems like overkill.
Yeah. Do you remember when it was probably more than 10 years ago now when Boise State had the horse head that took up the entire inside the three-point lines on both ends?
Yep.
That was crazy.
That was crazy. And for the record, Boise State, which of course does some funky things like with their blue turf.
Smurf turf.
Those football helmets that they've worn the past couple years with like the oversized horse head, it's almost like silver on the blue helmets, is awesome. Those are fantastic. You know, sometimes the rest of their uniforms are a little over the top, but those helmets are unbelievable.
Yeah.
Speaking of strange things on the court, one of the other court designs we haven't spoken about is the Cal State Northridge one, which is gray, and I'd love to hear your take.
Paul Lucas was not a fan. I imagine it's going to be a very polarizing design. I think it's kind of crazy awesome. It sort of defies all logic when you look at it. I don't know what I'm looking at, because it's not like a basketball court I've ever seen. It's sort of light gray wood, and then a darker gray inside the 3-point line with the jet black paint, and then a popping orange logo in the middle. Somehow all those crazy things line up into a solid design for me. I don't know how exactly.
For me, the logo and the type in the center of the court doesn't work as well, but the gray on black, I think, looks really slick. It's almost as if they're bringing like a blacktop feel to an indoor court, and I thought it came off really cool. I wish the logo in the background wasn't as huge, and I wish the type in the middle of the court wasn't as huge. I feel like there's a little bit off balance there.
Yeah.
But inside the 3-point lines, I think is fantastic.
And it lets them do something that I'm not sure most schools can do, or most anybody can do. I off the top of my head, I don't know if anybody else does it, but they can have white lines for the 3-point line and the hash marks in the lane and everything, and they're still visible.
All right, we're doing a design game road trip to Cal State Northridge.
Let's do it.
But yeah, I'm all for it. I'd say there's nothing wrong with experimenting in court design. And even if something fails horribly, you can roll something new out the next year.
That's a problem, though, for me. Like, especially with uniforms. But even now, so with courts, I mentioned Northwestern before. This is the second court design they've had in 4 years. And so much of this seems to be about marketing and recruiting, sort of equal time to both, you know, sell more material, get talking points for your school and your program, and be able to sell the program to incoming players. But what you gain in those things, I feel like you lose in brand equity and prestige if you're changing your uniforms all the time and changing your court all the time.
Totally fair, and you're right, and that's probably why we love Indiana and North Carolina so much, because over time they haven't changed that much and there's so much brand equity there. Now with a school like Cal State Northridge, you know, their hoops team isn't, of course, on the par with those traditions, so they get a little bit more flexibility. But you're right, you've got to find something that works. And then either don't change it or slightly modify it over time, and that's going to bring you some more of that brand and tradition equity that you're talking about.
Yeah. Like, you look at the schools, like the classic basketball schools, Duke and Kentucky and North Carolina and Arizona and UConn, they'll update their jerseys, like little things here and there, year after year, like all these other schools too, but they mostly stay the same in terms of typography and numbering, to the point where you can tell a Kentucky jersey and you can tell a Duke jersey, even if it were in black and white and the letters didn't say Duke. It was like PQNR, just because they've had the same typography and the same, you know, styling for, like, Duke uses type on a path. They have a curve. Duke is curved on the front, where Kentucky's is straight across, and North Carolina has theirs stacked north above the number and Carolina below the number. And those things last, and I think they're much stronger because of that. And I would include Syracuse in there if they had stuck with that typeface they used from the early 90s through the early 2000s, which was sort of like that stretched, I believe it was Myriad, a sort of altered form of Myriad. But then when they got those new Nike Hyper Elite uniforms, they changed it up to this sort of block type, which matches the new logo. And who knows, maybe if they stick with that for the next 50, 60 years, it will bring some of that equity. But for now, it feels like they lost a connection with their tradition to me.
You mentioned UConn in passing, and they made some nice adjustments this year to kind of harken back to those UConn jerseys that we love so much back in like the Khalid El Amin years with the really compressed type on the front where it had the whole word Connecticut, which were, that's to me, that's like an all-time college hoops uni.
Oh, yeah. Another one of those basketball schools that sort of does a good job with keeping their type and numbering consistent is Louisville. But they've stepped out of bounds this year with this new... They were one of the Adidas schools that used the template with the colored shoulders like Kansas did last year, which we were not a fan of. And this year they've countered that by putting... I don't even know. I called it a cummerbund on Twitter. Like, I thought that the Phoenix Suns had that new, the new shorts where they have a stripe, like, halfway down the butt in the back that makes it look like they're sagging their pants because you think it's the waistband. This takes that to the extreme. It looks like they're wearing one of those old-timey ab machine belts that, you know, that, like, vibrates you around. These are terrible. You mentioned...
Oh, they're so bad.
You talked about this, the waistband on the Celtics calling attention to the man area. Well, this takes that to a new level.
It would be as if you took, like, if you had a colored waistband on your uniform and say it was 2 inches tall and they just made it like 8 inches tall. And it is so terrible. It's so out of balance. It doesn't make any sense. It calls attention to the man area. Like you said, it's like a total game misconduct, if to use a hockey analogy, and it's like a horrible, horrible thing that happened to uniform design.
5-minute major.
Totally 5-minute major, game misconduct, personal foul, whatever you want to call it. It's all of those things, and Louisville gets the big red X from us on that one.
Ugh.
And really, there's no better way to wrap up a show than slamming Louisville in their terrible uniforms.
Yeah, in pure disgust.
We hope you enjoyed listening to us ramble in between sports and nerderies. If the over-under was 20 episodes for our first Magic the Gathering reference, so if you bet the under, you won. Check us out on Twitter at The Design Game. Maybe we'll tweet out some basketball card photos in the not-too-distant future. And, of course, we'd love for you to subscribe to us on iTunes and even leave us a review, if you wouldn't mind. But until next time... send us your favorite court design, check out what's new in the NBA and college hoops, and steer clear of those Louisville unis.
Stay away.
No good designs are walking through that door.